Possession number 17183, Roman Halter, reel 11, followed after a pause by reel 12. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel informant and interviewer together.
Roman Halter, reel 11.
Hodditch suddenly became a very sad place for me, and I thought to myself that I'll go back to Lodge, and Podlaski helped me with a certain amount of money, which was really the train fare to Lodge. Also, he told me that, and my father before he died told me that he buried in an oak chest some soap, and I managed to dig this out, and Podlaski sold some, and I took some with me, and he made my way to Lodz Ghetto. And I thought that if I go to the black market and sell some of the soap and do a certain amount of transaction, I might find a way of surviving somewhere. I thought the war is finished. My life is not in danger, and perhaps there will be a way of living and working somewhere. And when I went to the black market, I saw somebody called Liebeck Silberschatz. He had a number of brothers, and one of his brothers was a section leader in the metal factory in Lodz Ghetto. The others were very wild and verging on sort of crude and rough, but the brother who was section leader was very nice, and he taught me various things in the tool making section, and I had an affection for him. So Liebeck was one of the youngest, and he was totally untamed. He was a sort of bronco person. When I met him in Lodz Ghetto, he had a bag of hard-boiled eggs, and we went behind the block, sat down and ate the eggs, and he said, "Do you know, a proportion of us were shot on the march, but the rest managed to reach Theresienstadt." And my brother reached Theresienstadt that day. I came here because my family buried something, some rings, some valuables, and I came to dig them out and said, "I've got them all sewn up in my swimming costume, which is a sort of woolen stuff around the waist." So he said, "If you like, you can come with me. I'm going back to Theresienstadt." And we exchanged the story quite briefly. And I was foolish enough, really, to tell him that I dug out some of the soap that my father buried, and some of the tea and sugar, but some of it was bad, and the soap was all right, and I brought it here. So he helped me to perform certain transaction. And he said, "Trust me, be all right. The war is ended. Everything will be fine." And he was older than I. I was then reaching 18, and he was about 21 or so. And when I told him that I gave everything my father left to Podlaski and took some of the soap, he said, "Don't be silly. We'll go back to Hodditch and get some of that soap. It's all yours. What's the matter with you? Are you soft in the head? Fur, we can sell that. We can sell this." So he insisted of us going back. I really had no stomach for it. But I came there and I said to Podlaski, "Say that you haven't got it finished, because he's insisting on it. What you, if you like." So he said, "Well, I can give you a little bit more of the soap, but it's only washing soap, and take him away with you." We came to the marketplace where a Russian on a horse arrived and had a bicycle holding like that. And he said, "For a little bottle of vodka, I give you the bicycle." So the Poles were very aware that you don't make transactions with these Cossacks, with these wild men. But Liebeck said, "All right, I'll bring you a bottle of vodka." And he went, and for a piece of soap, he got this little bottle of homebrew vodka. And he said, "Now, give me the bicycle, and I'll throw you the vodka. And this man was on a horse. The whole Polish circle looked at it, and he got the bicycle and threw the vodka, and the Russian sort of got hold of it and didn't drop it. And Leibel jumped on the bicycle, and this man drank a little vodka and started chasing him on the horse, and became quite a spectacle. Anyway, Leibel won. He managed to dash in into sort of corner where the horse couldn't go through, and came out and hid, and then he sold the bicycle to somebody, and he said, all right, we had enough of adventure, let's go back. We went to the station. People traveled without a ticket, and we went back to lodge, and we stayed with some people who also returned to lodge. They managed to have this sort of like a corridor somewhere where we slept, and the following day we set off for Czechoslovakia, for Theresienstadt. We came to the border, and we couldn't get through the border. So Leibel had a plan. He would go to a bar where Russian officers drink and look at the faces, and if he had found a sympathetic face, ask him if he could take us across the border. So he swapped one of his rings or something like that for vodka, and went with his vodka behind his jacket. And so a very pleasant-looking face by the bar. So he said, I will give you a bottle of vodka if you take us across the border. So this officer said, bottle of vodka and a woman. You find me a woman who wants to go across the border. So we went to the station, and Leibel said, who wants to come across to Czechoslovakia? So one woman said, oh, yes, that's where I want to go. So he said, well, come with me. And he said, this woman wants to go across the border to Czechoslovakia. So the Russian said, harasho. And he took the three of us. He kicked everybody out from the compartment. We had to be on the corridor. And he was just with this woman in the compartment. As soon as we took us across the border to the other side, he said he has to return, and we're on our own. When we came to Prague, I went together with him to the Red Cross. There was a very nice man and a woman, and they were registering people who survive and doing various things. When I told them the story, they said, oh, poor you, you must come to our home, and you'll be able to wash up, and my husband will give you some clothes. And Leibel said, no, I'm not staying. I'm going back to Theresienstadt. I'll see you there. Goodbye. It was all very gallant, sort of, I don't know what gallant is, the thing, but very lighthearted. And he left. I went to these people. And that was really the first time properly that I had a bath and slept in a bed and had clean pajamas, which were too large for me. And I felt, oh, I felt so good. And this man gave me some of his clothes, much too big for me, but still, I wore this. And they were very concerned what I will do. And I said, I'm going back to Theresienstadt. And not back, but my colleague went back, and I'm going there because some of the people survived. So they said, well, if you find yourself in difficulty, come back to us. You know where we are. So I said, but I have another debt to pay. I have some soap, and I'm going to transact on the blank market because Mr. and Mrs. Fuchs sheltered me, and I want to go back and show my appreciation. So they said, well, if you have to do it, you have to do it. And they fully understood, and I went and sold soap on one side and bought something on the other side. And eventually, when I had this sort of ersatz coffee, which was once used, and some sugar which was full of other grains inside, and some speck, the whole sort of bag of goods, I went to the station. The trains were overcrowded in both ways, coming from Germany, going to Germany. But it said it goes towards Dresden. So I traveled on top of the train. I did what Leibel did in Lodge Ghetto. I boiled some hard-boiled eggs, some eggs in, I made them hard-boiled and took it with me to eat on the journey. And I was traveling on top of the roof, strapping myself. There were two cables there running, so I shouldn't fall off. And the men in front, when we came to a bridge, used to shout something, and we all lay back off front. We shouldn't be knocked off. And eventually I reached Dresden, and it was still a few kilometers to Oberpeuritz. I managed to wash up because I was black from that cold soot up on top, and made my way towards Mrs. Fuchs. First, the door was locked there, so I knocked on the door on the neighbor, and there was a woman with a young child, and she suddenly was very nice to me, and she knew that I was there with Mrs. Fuchs. And she gave me some liquid, sort of like a soup and a piece of bread, and then she brought out the album of her family. She was quite pleasant. And suddenly I saw a photo of her husband with a SS death mark on the head. So I went, oh, SS! Suddenly I reacted to it, and she took this away. And she said, he was fighting on the Eastern Front. He was conscripted like other people. And I hope that he's alive and he will return. And her eyes filled with tears. And she said, you better wait outside. So I waited outside. Then I knocked again. Mrs. Fuchs came out all dressed in black. And she said, I can't see you, I can't see you. Better get out. What do you want here? So I said, why? So she said, they came and shot my husband and shot Schweitzer. And get out, because they will shoot you. And she slammed the door in my face. So I knocked on the neighbor's door and I said, I brought some food for Mrs. Fuchs. Could you please give it to her? And left it, and I disappeared. And she took the bag, and I went back to Prague. I didn't go back to these very nice people who helped me. I went straight from there to Theresienstadt. When I came to Theresienstadt, I found some of the people from my transport living in the Kaserne, which was there, because Theresienstadt was before a military compound for soldiers, and now all these people who survived live there in these rooms. And she said, well, you can sleep here in my bed. And both of us slept in the bed. I was very concerned because there were still fleas in the blanket, and I was quite bitten, but I was so tired from the journey, I slept like a log, and I didn't know what to do the following day. And then I slept on a floor somewhere else. And then somebody said, you know, there's a home here for young people who are orphaned, and one doctor has arranged this, and eventually they're going to be taken somewhere else. Why don't you go and apply? So I went along there, and they interviewed me, and they said, are you 16? So I said, no, I'm coming on to 18. So they said, no, you are 16. You were born 1929, and you are 16, I remember, and this is your little card. And they filled it in, and they said, come inside. Can you see this big bunk up on top? You sleep up there. That's yours. And because I was so tired, when I lay down, I found they gave me a blanket, and the whole thing with had a sort of long straw-filled sack all the way. I lay down, took somebody's pillow and lay on it, fell asleep. Suddenly, another youth of about my age sat on my chest with a knife and said, I'll knife you if you don't give me back my pillow. So I said, oh, please leave me alone. I just turned over to the other side. I just couldn't care and fell asleep. Anyway, he crawled off me. And these were all survivors who are now part of the 45 Society, the Martin Gilbert, the boys. And one, Balsam, was on the other side of me. At night, I used to make up stories and tell them, because of tremendous adventure stories, and they loved it. Sometimes they used to say, right, time for story, tell us. And one day Balsam nudged me and he said, Roman, have you ever slept with a woman? And I never had this reawakening till I reached Theresienstadt. And there they gave us slightly better food. Also we received Ovaltine and tins, which we carried under our arm. And I said, no. So he said, you come with me tomorrow, and I will take you. I know a very good woman. So out of curiosity, I said, fine. So in the morning we got up. We had the usual thing, which was given there for breakfast. And he took me along to the kaserne and knocked on the door and winked and said, wait here. The door opened with a sort of slit on a chain. A very nice round face of a girl, sort of between 25 and 30, opened the slit. And she said in Yiddish, what do you want, Balzam? She knew him. So she said, he's a novice. We came for some sex. So he said, this time of day? It's morning. So he said, it's all right, but you have to show it to him. So he said, what did you bring me? So he said, what did you want? So he said, well, look, you have to bring me something, some meat or some sugar or something. You come empty-handed in the morning. So he said, what do you want? So she said, bring me something, come in the afternoon. So he slammed the door. So I said, what do we do now to this very experienced 17 or 18-year-old? So he said, what we are going to do is behind where the SS were, there's a big mound where they buried meat in tins. And he said, I know exactly what tins are right, what are not. Come with me. He said, first we have to search for two big nails. So we searched and found nails there. And we came there and he said, you see, when it's concave is right. When it's convex is right. When it's concave is wrong because it's blown. And he took one which was sort of blown up and he stuck the nail in and terrible smell came out from the tin. He said, that's bad. If you eat that, you're very ill. He said, but I know which are good. And we kept on searching through and we found this tin, which was equivalent to corned beef. And he said, this one is right. Just look. He stuck in the nail and he sniffed it. He said, smell. It's fresh. And we took it out aside and he managed to open it eventually. He had a sort of blade which was sharpened into a knife. And he said, I'll eat it first. Oh, delicious. You have some. So I had some. And he had some, and I had some, and he had some, and I had some. So I said, well, but you are not going to leave much for this girl. So I said, right, we close the tin now, we keep it like that, and we take it to the girl. But it's not time yet. So we sat and talked, and he said, tell me another story. And then eventually we went back there. We knocked on the door, and she came out again to the door. And she said, what did you bring me? So he said, we've got some meat here, you see, in the tin. So she opened the door, let us in. And she said, you taste it first. So Balzam took another little bit. And she smelt it and tasted it. She said, fine, and put it there. And it was a very bare room. On the little table, there was a bowl, a white ceramic bowl, and a little jug underneath. And she said, now let your trousers down. I have to inspect you. I am very clean. I am very particular. So we both stood with our trousers down. And she said, I'm going to wash myself and I'm going to wash you. And she washed herself. And then she poured it in a bucket underneath that. And then she washed us both. I said, right, who's first? So Balzam said, you go, Roman, you go, Roman. So I said, well, I don't know. Could I wait and see? So she lay down and said, well, come on, I haven't got the whole day to waste. So he went down, and when he lay on her, he said to me, come closer, so you can see how it's done. So I came closer, and eventually, and she said, right, you next. And she looked down, she said, oh, you are wet. And he said, oh, Roman, you wet. So I felt terribly embarrassed. I said, oh, I will come another day. And when we came back from this experience, he told all the other boys in the room, and I was a butt for a few days, how he, as a professor, managed, and I failed so miserably. And I see him now. So whenever I see him now in London, I call him Professor. And he said, so you learned, huh? And this is our standard jokes. And people want to know who is the professor. Theresienstadt was...
It's interesting this, because you would have been... You're 18, but very naive in a way, wouldn't you?
Well, the starvation retarded me terribly.
Yes.
And
in fact,
I felt less than 16 in many respects physically. It's only when we were brought to England, we were sent to Lake Windermere for recuperation, and the doctor said, if you want to put some meat and muscle on your bone, swim every day, that I started recovering, and I became quite good at swimming. But
you know, in your experience, was there no sexual experience at all? You know,
there was no desire in me, no. Because
did you see anything going on around you? Was it?
Yes, for instance, when we were taken to the Elbe by the SS, and there were no officers but ordinary SS men, and people had these blankets. Some of the women, because you must remember that originally we were sent from Stutthof. There were 284 women and 216 men. So some of them straight away huddled together with the women under the blanket, and certain things were going on where the SS were too preoccupied with their own survival that they took care. They just wanted to make certain that none of us escape. And under these blankets were both men and women. But, of course, this did not concern me. To me, it was as far as further than the moon. My mind was preoccupied with other things, either food or with survival.
The other thing was this homosexual advance that was made to you.
Yes.
By those two men.
Yes.
Was that ever, you know, did you ever face that sort of threat again?
No. What happened was that the woman SS officer in Dresden felt that Hans Braun, who was in the office, because he was kind towards the to us Jewish slave laborers, that he must have had a sort of keen eye on me. So whenever I saw her, we had to stand to attention, take our cap off. She would try to kick me in the groin. But she was a sadistic person. She was the one who hit me on the head when we were selected to be shot. And I felt really that on the march, had I not run away, she would have found excuse of killing me. Because somehow she took it against me, and I felt that. And I feared her greatly. Not only because she was an SS, but because I was marked out by her. I was spared this because many people in Auschwitz who had green designations, who were murderers and who were homosexuals, sorted out certain boys as whom they've used and abused. But I was too starved. I wasn't the sort of favorite in the line.
Yes, it's interesting. You're telling me about the boys, really, aren't you? And how you became sort of part of that group.
Yes. For instance, there was another incident that the sun was shining. It was June, and I said to them that I learned to swim when I was young in my town of Hodage, in the lake, that we should go out to the Elbe and swim, and some of them came with me. And we were then guarded by the Russians, so we broke through an area there where the Russians couldn't quite see us. And I said to them, we don't have to be afraid of the Russians, because, after all, they won't shoot us. The most thing is that might hit us. But they are not going to shoot us. So we broke through this fence, went towards the Elbe. I was the only one who could swim. The others paddled. And we had a lovely time. It was sunny. and the stream carried me down, and I came out and came back to them. Eventually we had enough, and we dressed again when the sun dried us, and we walked across the field, and we came across a field of strawberries, and we lay in the strawberries, and I said, well, that's really liberation, and at strawberries on both sides. And my vision of liberation was really lying in the field of strawberries. And there were these moments. Then there was also a swimming pool in Theresienstadt, a very small one, perhaps 20 meter long, and full of rubbish. And I organized a group where we cleared up the rubbish and let water in. And then we were swimming there. And some of the colleagues who were in that house, in this boys' house, girls' house, I taught them how to swim. But now if I think about it, I said the best way to swim is to jump in. And if you struggle, I'll give you a hand. And this was the means of swimming. There was no shallow end, it was just a deep end. Fortunately, no one was drowned. And another boy, who's now a very orthodox rabbi in Stamford Hill, came back and he said, I broke out and went to Litomerice, and there's a baker, Czech baker, and he makes lovely rolls. I'll go tomorrow and I'll bring a pillowcase full of rolls. So we waited for him to come with his fresh rolls, and he came back. He could hardly sit on his bottom. So then he told us the story. He went there and he said to the baker, fill up this pillowcase with rolls, fresh rolls. The baker said, what have you got to give me in exchange? So he said, nothing, fill it up. So this boy, when the baker refused, this boy took out a gun from his pocket and placed it on the counter. He said, you know what I'm going to do? So the baker took the gun and said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. And he took him behind the counter, took down his trousers, and gave him 20 hard smacks. And he came back with a very sore bottom.
And who's so, that? Who was he?
Well, I've got even his photograph there. So if you like, I can send you the photo. Kuchmierski.
This meeting up and your relationship with the boys, was this going to be very important for you and your development at that stage, do you think?
Well, at that stage, I didn't know this because I was totally lost. When I was in Prague with these very kind people from the Red Cross, I remember the address of my aunt, and I asked them if they could send a card or letter to her. And I wrote in Polish that I'm alive, I've survived, and I'm in writing it from Prague, that my aunt Wiene, who was living in Switzerland, in Lausanne, is Schmon de Cedre. And they said they are going to post it, they are going to get in touch with her. And I said, I don't know where I'm going to end up, but if they would get in touch with the Red Cross, I will eventually tell the Red Cross where I am, and so they could locate me. Apart from her, I really had no one. My grandmother, I remembered, my mother's mother, who went to Palestine, and my grandfather remained. I didn't remember her address. But I thought to myself, in the meantime, I'll go to England, or I'll go to America. And England appealed to me because my father had a stepbrother who came to Liverpool. And when he finished serving in the Tsar Army, whether it was 1903, he came and he related a story that before crossing the Channel, his mother roasted a goose for him. And he was so hungry, and he had a tanker of beer. And he used to say, I'm sure the beer was kosher. And he ate the goose and drank the beer, and he slept for 24 hours because he was so tired from the journey, and then came here. And his brother looked after certain investments of his. That's the uncle in his Vita Kujawska. And he found that his stepbrother in Liverpool was rather poor. He was a scribe in the synagogue. And so he returned back to Poland without shoelaces. He really had a very tough time, because not knowing the language and not having work, it was very hard for him. But during the 3 months, he picked up enough of Pidgin English to such an extent that when I was being bathed as a child in the wooden tub, I would remember the words my father uttered in English, and I would improvise certain words, and I thought I could speak English because I was making these bubbling noises. So that's as much as I knew about England. Also, Mrs. Wiśniewska, when she was teaching us geography, would put a map on the wall, and on this map there was this area colored pink, and she said, "This is the British Empire." And the world was covered with these pink areas. One thought, "Oh, must be a wonderful place, all these places." So this is how far my knowledge extended. And really, I wanted to get as far away from Poland and Germany as I possibly could. And so I grasped Tenistro, and they said that we are going to be sent to England. That was fine with me.
Could you tell me something, though, about the boys themselves? You know, who these people were?